with the power and the experiences to get me sometimes, and I was thankful for him being in this world. I was thankful enough to try to stay far away from him and Pam, but like I said, he was the only one who could tell me if I was right or not about what I was dealing with. I described in very esoteric terms the resonance of the creature's departure and how it had retreated not to an outside realm but to the interior of the mindscape, the Akashic, Wayne's turf.
Oh,
Wayne said, that's not good.
Yeah, I said, and I described the type of shredding that had been done to Alextra, to the room, as I slipped the picture of Crystal back in my pocket.
Damn,
Wayne said.
That sounds exactly like crash card or rib spreader.
Did you get a look at it? Did it look metallic? Surgical? Did it have wheels instead of legs?
I'm not sure, Wayne, I said. Its shadow didn't look human at all. You sound pretty certain it's one of them.
It is, isn't it? I thought you and the other acid mancers destroyed all of them in the Helter Skelter War.
I thought we did, Wayne said. I felt ice and perhaps fear settle in his voice.
I truly thought we did. I lost so many dear friends fighting them, purging them from the zeitgeist, from the Akashic record. I'm sorry, son, I agree with you. I wish I didn't. It sounds like one of the nightmare tulpa.
I felt fear shrink my balls, too. These things were legendary, powerful, evil-given form.
There's only supposed to be one man who could call them up, build them in his bug-house crazy skull, I said.
Yes, Wayne said grimly.
Manson.
18. I've spent enough time in prisons on both sides of the cage to understand that when you walk through those seemingly normal doors, past offices and break rooms, checkpoints and metal detectors, you are stepping into a parallel universe. You pass beyond the veneer of the civilized, normal, safe world into a realm beyond sunlight and mercy into the forge. The greatest thing to fear on the inside, guard or con, is yourself, what you will do, what you're capable of just to breathe another day, to survive until you make it back to that other soft world or die trying. Most of the people in prison are there because they're fucked up, not out of some great inherent moral failing, more like a sick comedy of errors. They were just tired, drunk, angry, bitter, or broke at the wrong place at the wrong time. They fucked up, usually in a split second. They made a choice, and it was usually the wrong one. Then there are the folks who are inside due to no fault of their own, but because the gatekeepers fucked up. Innocent people fall through the cracks in a clattering, overloaded system that struggles to maintain a facade of safety and order, a system made up of fallible mortals who are overworked, underpaid, stressed, jaded, distrusting, and sometimes racist. Then you have the smallest percentage of the population inside, the ones that you hope never get out, never breathe free air, the monsters. I was meeting an old monster today. Wayne English had been unable to make it out to L.A. in the rapidly dwindling time I now had to wrap up this caper before my former associates in the august body of the Nightwise came for me and kicked my ass out of town. He had tag-teamed with Grinner to produce an airtight cover for me as some kind of shadowy federal agent from some nebulous organization. I think Grinner insisted the acronym for the make-believe agency be ASS. So now here I was, in the bowels of Corcoran State Prison, clean-shaven, hair slicked back and in a tight ponytail, wearing a charcoal-gray Fioravanti suit with a pale purple Turnbull and Asser tie. I look good, James Bond good. That's me. Lathan Ballard, international cracker of mystery, the man from Ass. English had also done me one final solid. I tucked it away in case I needed it later. I had all the proper credentials, all the necessary emails and verification. For the next 12 hours, this identity was golden. The two best hackers in the universe had even managed to get me a private interview, a whole 30 minutes. It wouldn't take that long to find out everything I needed to know from the old monster if he was chatty today. The interview room I was let into by the old monster's keepers, a cadre of guards, the warden and a prison psychologist,
looked like any other corporate conference room except for the heavy steel door with the narrow sliver of a window made of steel mesh reinforced glass.
Mr. Blank,
the psychologist said, frowning as she read my fake last name off my clip-on visitor badge.
Are you sure you want to be in here without at least some prison staff present? I'd be willing to stay if you would feel more comfortable. He can be a bit of an overpowering personality, even given his failing physical health.
I'll be fine, doctor, I said. I'm kind of used to big personalities, and please call me Melvin. She smiled, arched her eyebrow, and nodded.
Very well. Good luck. He'll be brought in shortly.
Everyone left. I saw a few guards waiting outside the door. The room was quiet except for the hum of the AC. A few minutes passed, and I spent the time breathing, slowing my pulse. While the old monster was no threat physically, he was still formidable in the realm of power. I had felt his madness like a hot, angry wind as soon as I had entered the prison. I should have my defenses up and ready for him. The part of me that whispered I'd be more loose and ready for him if I had had that drink this morning told me I needed to know, to see how I fared bare-knuckle against him. Sober me told me I listened to that asshole way too much. There was an electronic click and buzz, and the steel door swung open. Charles Manson entered the room. He had steel-gray hair shaved up on the sides in a brush cut and a gray goatee. He was hunched over, his hands close in cuffs, connected to a body chain and then leg restraints, a shuffling old hippie. He looked at me. A little smile played at his lips, and I felt his presence scrape and claw at the edges of my power, looking for cracks to seep in through. The swastika scar was there, above eyes as black and devoid of life as the death between stars. I had heard he had been very sick, and I saw in him that he wasn't much longer for this world. A horrible thought occurred to me then. Would death be enough? Would death erase his stain from the world? Manson nodded and grunted at me as the guards sat him down and locked him to a chair opposite me at the conference table.
"Who the hell are you?"
he said. I had been interrogated enough times to know that I'd make him wait. Charlie decided not to play my game.
"You're witchy. I can feel it coming off of you like stink off a whore. Ain't no agent man, though. No FBI, are you, witchy man?"
"Cut the shit, Charlie," one of the guards said under his breath. "Behave. Answer the nice man's questions and don't make us come back in here until he's done. Got it?" Manson bobbed his head rapidly a few times, looked up with hooded eyes, and smiled at me. It was the famous Manson smile, the Manson eyes, and I have to admit it had power to it. My stomach curled, and I felt his energy prying at the tiny crack in my armor his demeanor had created. The guard who had admonished Manson explained to me that they would be right outside if I needed anything. They departed without another word. There was a loud clank as the heavy door closed and locked, and I was alone with the self-proclaimed devil. Having met them both, I have to say Charlie was scarier.
"I could kill you right now," he said. "Be across that table before anybody could do shit."
"Take your shot," I said. "I can job your nasty, decrepit ass before you haul yourself over that table." Manson glared at me and then broke into laughter.
"Shit, man, you're all right," Charlie said. "I'd kill you. I don't get Pop-Tarts. I like Pop-Tarts more than pussy these days. Why you here? What's your handle?"
I pointed to my name badge. Charlie squinted and then made a face.
"Melvin Blank? Shit, that's the Bugs Bunny guy. What's your real name, the one you call yourself in the dark? That's the only one that matters."
"Latham Ballard," I said. Mel Blank sounded like as good a name as any to deal with Looney Tunes Charlie. Manson leaned back, a smug expression crossing his weathered face.
"Ballard, yeah. They said you might come visit, said I shouldn't say shit to you. They think you're dangerous."
Charlie gave me the once-over, nodded.
"You are. You got it in the eyes, all right, just like me."
"Who's they, Charlie? Who said not to tell me?" Manson seemed to be doing the calculus of betrayal in his head. I sweetened the pot by holding up a pack of American spirits. He grinned. His teeth were small and yellow like a rat's. He reached out for the smokes, and I withdrew them. He became irritated.
Spill, I said.
Shit.
Why the hell not, man? He said. Not like they can dream up something to get me in here as long as I've got my guardian angels. No one can touch me in here. I'm a god, and this is my temple.
Who? I asked again, trying to keep the irritation out of my voice. I was painfully aware of how sober I was. Mance's energies were frantic, constant like a dog scratching at the door. He could tell he was getting to me. It was remarkable. Charles Manson was no wizard, nothing special, but he was a charisma savant. He had raw presence that gave him power over the weak, the young, the scared, the gullible, and the damaged. For all my training, all my godlike ability, at my core, I was a broken human being, and Manson was masterful at worming his way in, spotting your flaws, and crawling inside you. I centered myself and waited, cigarettes in hand.
The process, he said, clutching the air with his manacled hands and nodding toward the smokes. I handed him the pack. He fumbled to open it.
The process? The process church of the final judgment, the cult? Charlie bobbed his head and popped a cigarette between his lips. He murmured in the affirmative.
Yeah, he said. That's one of their names. It's what they called themselves when I met them.
I thought they folded up shop in the '70s, I said.
Changed their name, he said. Changed their face, put the old one in a jar by the door. They've been around a long, long time. They call themselves different now. They still own this city just like they did back then, pretty much have for a long time. They like it here. L.A. matches their, you know, vibe.
I leaned back in my chair and rubbed my face. This could all be the famous Manson rambling bullshit, but there were still rumors in the life that the idea for Manson's race war apocalypse, Helter Skelter, was borrowed in part from the doctrine of the Process Church.
You mean to say that people from the Process came to you recently to warn you about me specifically, Charlie? Are you jerking me around?
You'll see, Manson said.
You got a light?
Yeah, I said, I do. I didn't move or make any attempt to give the little dirtbag anything.
Charlie, what would the process want from you after all this time? It have anything to do with the tulpa?
My head babies, Manson said.
Yeah, that's why you're here, ain't it?
A thing that may have been one of yours tore a very nice lady and her asshole boyfriend to shreds last night. How is that even possible, Charlie? I thought all those things were destroyed by the acid mancers.
You mean Timmy's little helpers?
Manson sneered.
Hell, man, they tried. But I had lots of time in here to figure out a go-around. They don't exist in the fancy, snobby, think-you're-better-than-me collective unconscious anymore, yeah. But I made my own one of those in here. And then I put them back together in my mind and birthed them right in the jailhouse, just like the jailhouse was my mother. I tried hard to not show this lunatic how impressed I was by what he was telling me. When Wayne and the other acid mancers sealed Manson nightmare creations off from the collective thought stream of mankind, Charlie had created his own new collective thought gestalt, using the isolated emotional minds of all those locked away in the prisons of the world, his own private mass mind of fear, anger, and brutal awareness, an untapped Jungian jungle. It would take decades of isolated meditation to build such an occult construct and then populate it with the worst nightmares and most horrific fantasies of those on the inside. Charlie had the deranged focus to do it, and we had given him the quiet, the silence, and the time.
Yeah, Manson said. You got it. It's beautiful, isn't it, man? Something you wished you'd thought up yourself, something you could have... You're jealous you didn't. I can see that in the shitty marbles your soul peeks out of.
It's impressive, I said. Then give me a fucking light for my cancer stick, Charlie said, gesturing with the cigarette as best he could with the manacles. I remained still.
You're no miracle man, Charlie, I said. If you were, you wouldn't be locked up in here still.
Manson laughed again. Look at her, so enlightened, so blind. These walls... They're glass. They're mirrors.
What's in here is all of you on the outside. We're just not as good at faking we're good people, that we're civilized like you pretend. You're the prisoners, not me. I dreamed all of your world up. In here, in my world, that's the only thing that's real. You're all ghosts living in a god's dream, my dream. I tried to let his words move through me without tainting my insides, told myself it was the rantings of a narcissistic psychopath. Manson nodded, looking almost grim. Ask what you came to ask, ghost man, then go back to your haunted world. Why did you call up the Tulpa to kill Elektra and George? Who told you to? I don't know who the fuck you're talking about. I didn't wake any of my children up. An awareness crossed Manson's face like he just got the punchline of a joke. He looked surprised and a bit smug. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, right on. He did it. Who did it? I leaned closer. Who did it, Charlie, if it wasn't you? My boy, he said. My son. They said they were going to teach him the way they taught me. The process, I said. They're gone, Charlie. Scorched earth. I need to know who really killed Elektra and why. People always got to go and try to put labels on things, Manson said. Things don't change what they're made of because their form changes. You call a glass of water a river, tell me it isn't really. You call death a cigarette. What they are stays the same regardless if you call them the process or something else. They're not hung up on names, blinders to what's real. And what are they, Charlie? What's real? Manson showed me the cigarette and smiled. They're looking to move on, to move up, get that enlightened Jones a-going, except they got it right, not like all those Bible thumpers and prissy-ass Satanists. They get you can't know light unless you know the dark, and after a while spent in either, you go blind and the dark wins out anyway. It was my turn to get it. They're seeking out enlightenment by courting the dark, embracing it, I said. Charlie nodded. Yeah, it's beautiful, baby. His eyes were looking into places I couldn't see. They put my feet on the path a long time ago. I was walking it and didn't even know it till they showed me. They taught me the real meaning of family. Children, man, they are the harbingers of our own end and the gateway to immortality. I'm going to live forever. My seed is in all the blood of mankind now, just like theirs. Everything I foretold is coming to pass right now. The race riots, the hate and anger, the end of the wagging tongues, the dawn of the raising of fists, the whites and the blacks going to war. I'm a prophet, and that will be borne out by history. They send me out as their prophet. Showed me all of it. Manson cocked his head and gave me an almost pitying look. They'll show you, too. They like you, Ballard, and that's why they haven't killed you yet. Okay, Charlie, I said, leaning closer. This one is for a light for that cigarette and a carton of smokes. I want you to explain something to me, and I want every detail. And he did. It's a cult, I said to Grinner, Anna, and Vigil. A cult of Buddhist mystics. The murder of Jane, of all the girls. Their ritual sacrifices for them, designed to provide empowerment and further their messed-up take on enlightenment. It all makes sense now. We were in the office at the hard limit, and daylight was burning. I had spent the morning with Manson, and I now had much less than 24 hours to get out of Dodge. Gita had ordered Dragon out of town on an assignment shortly after we had our little chat. Dragon was to go back to Bombay Beach, where Jane's body had been dumped in 1984, to follow up on local interviews. Dragon and I both knew it was bullshit, a way to keep her from helping me and compromising herself to the Nightwise. I had urged her to go. I didn't want to cause her any more grief than I already had. Gita was making her take Luke along, supposedly as a partner, but really to keep an eye on her, make sure she was nowhere near me.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Hold the phone, Grinner said. We're talking freaking Buddhists here. No attachment, right? You know, letting go of aggression and resentment. The Mr. Rogers of religions, right? The sun's nuts, Ballard. I think you and Manson shared too many magic toadstools, man.
Not a lot of people in the West realize it. But there are different sects and opposing philosophies and traditions in Buddhism, Anna said, sipping her mint tea. It's not monolithic, any more than any other faith. They've had their internal struggles over doctrine and their versions of reformations and heresies.
I nodded in agreement. Exactly, I said. I remember hearing about this particular heresy at the night schools of Shambhala when I was studying in the Tian Shan Mountains. They're called the Dugpa, or Dogpa, but that's a really loose and inaccurate translation. Dugpa is kind of like calling all Southerners Klan or all Muslims terrorists. The West doesn't have an accurate word to describe what they are. None of my teachers wanted to discuss them very much. It was forbidden, so of course I was all over it. Natch, Grinner said, tipping his coffee mug in my direction. They're practitioners of Black Tantra, I continued. Selfish, greedy, ruthless sorcerers. Their view of Buddhism is ass backwards from everyone else's. They believe that cultivating negative emotions and thoughts leads to enlightenment. Attachment, possession, in all its extreme tangible and metaphysical forms, is to be embraced.
Okay. Grinner nodded. So, Sith Buddhists got it.
Nothing is considered sacred to them, I continued.
The very notion of sacredness is a joke. They embrace experience in all its permutations and perversions, and they gain mystical power through self-destruction and the corruption of others. Anna, Vigil, and Grinner all looked at each other, and I felt an uncomfortable understanding pass between them.
What?
I asked.
It's nothing, Latham,
Anna said.
Go on.
The Dugpa were briefly associated with the Kagyu sects, but not for long. Many of the oldest and most prominent Buddhist sects, like the Kagyu, got painted with the same racist broad brush by Madame Blavatsky and some other Western occultists because of the Dugpa. She lumped these assholes in with all the different Kagyu and two other very old and reputable branches of Buddhism. It's something the Red Hat sects have been trying to clear up ever since with Westerners.
Wait a second, Vigil said. Brett Glide's production company is called Red Hat.
Yeah, I said. It's one of the Western names for the Dugpa. I should have picked that up when we were out in the desert, but I was too hungover, I guess, just not thinking straight. Glide's in this somehow. He registered to me and Dragon like someone with some magical training. I should have known.
I ran his prints off the water bottle like you asked, and it completely fucked up the Fed's NGI identification system I ran them through,
Grinner said. Just like mine would do, I said. He's got some serious magic working.
No shit, Grinner said. So I've put him under a microscope, and you're right. Mr. Crunchy Granola is up to his tits in your and Dragon's cold case. I was able to use facial recognition software matched up to a massive porn image search program to determine that every woman murdered had been active in the adult film industry here in L.A., either online or in films, clubs, chat rooms, or all of the above. They were all working in adult entertainment, and I just found another major correlation between them in the wee hours of last night while you were out playing footsie with your old girlfriend. Every woman killed all the way back to the first you found in 1984. They had one thing in common. They had all worked for Red Hat Productions at some point in their careers.
It's a small community, relatively speaking,
Anna said.
Could just be a coincidence.
If we didn't know that Glide was connected to the Life, Vigil said, and that his company is named after these Dugpa, it stretches coincidence pretty far.
Crystal Myth worked for Red Hat too, didn't she? I said, already knowing the answer.
Yeah,
Grinner said.
And that breaks coincidence,
Anna nodded.
How did you know,
Vigil asked me,
that she was connected to your old case?
I took out the crumpled still from one of Crystal's movies I had found at Alextra's murder scene. I laid the blood-flecked, wrinkled print out on the desk between us. I pointed to a scar on her hip, an ornate brand made up of lines and whorls with sharp-pointed swoops on the ends of the pattern.
Is that what I think it is?
Anna asked. I nodded. That, I said. All the victims had it somewhere on their bodies. Sometimes it was fresh, a few weeks old. Other times it had been there for a while, probably years, but always the same symbol. No one in the night wise. LAPD, FBI, even Langley's code breakers could ever figure out what it meant until this morning, until I found out we're dealing with Dugpa.
What is it?
Anna asked.
Looks like fucking Klingon,
Grinner offered. It's from the Tibetan alphabet, I said. The symbols have been packed together and then reversed like a mirror image. It says Makadpa. That means offering.
Of course it does, Grinner muttered, looking at the old photo. Shit. You think your lost girl, this Cairn, crystal meth, you're looking for is dead?
Vigil searched my face. His jaw was tight. I don't think so, I said. Not yet, anyway. Every victim's body was dropped someplace they would be discovered pretty quickly, like the killers were showing off what they did. The Dugpa corrupt by weakening the resolve, challenging belief. Nothing like a brutal, senseless torture murder to shake up your faith in a just and ordered universe, right? Each one of these 9 murders gave them mystical fuel. That's why the heads were left pristine on each woman, to allow them to feed off the suffering and death pouring through their perfect ajna and their sahasrara's chakras, the seats of awareness and enlightenment. It's sick as hell, but it makes perfect sense.
So they degraded these women over years,
Anna said.
Wore them down, ruined their lives, destroyed their hope, and then, when they had nothing left to lose, tortured them, killed them, and
ate their souls, I said, like it was caviar. By that point, the women were probably thankful for the utter negation of their life force. They wouldn't just want to die, they'd wish they had never been born and never be reborn. They'd beg the Dugpa for annihilation. It's bad. It's fucked up on a different level even for me.
We have got to stop these evil things,
Anna said. I nodded.
They're not monsters, darling, just human beings. That's all they need to be. I've got 10 hours to find them and punch their ticket.
And find the Lady Anku, Vigil said. If she's not dead, she is in danger from this cult.
Agreed, I said, but we've very little time before I have the fucking Mojo Popo up my ass.
We can't deal with the assembled might of the Nightwise,
Vigil said.
Yeah, I said, that would suck, especially since that would include Dragon 2.
Damn it, Latham, you can't put her in that position,
Anna said.
All she has is the Nightwise. She believes in what the Order is about, even if you don't anymore.
I know, I said, rubbing my face. I felt so tired, and I was painfully aware of every hour, every minute, every second it had been since I'd had a drink. I'll figure something out, Anna. I won't hurt her. I won't make her choose, I promise.
Don't promise,
Anna said.
I know what that's worth. Just do it, okay? Please.
I poked a little deeper into Red Hat,
Grinner said, coming to the rescue.
It's weird. That company is older than Brett Clyde. It's been creeping around under different names, but same holding company since at least the 1970s. Probably further back than that. The electron trail gets cold past a certain date.
Manson claims the process is part of this, too, that they were his patrons here in L.A. That fits with the 70s.
It does,
Grinner said.
The process?
Vigil asked.
The process, Church of the Final Judgment,
Grinner said.
A cult started by a couple of nut burgers in England. They went international for a while in the mid-60s.
Their doctrine was often mistaken for Satanism because they worshipped 3 forces, including Christ and Satan, but it's actually closer to Dugpa philosophy, embracing the negative to become a fully self-actualized human being. They folded tents under the process name in the 70s.
Just in time for Red Hat Productions to open its doors here as the latest incarnation of whatever this fucked up mess is,
Grinner said.
Nice.
God, Latham,
Anna said.
Is it possible something this awful could be operating here in L.A. for generations, shifting around like some dummy corporation or tax shelter, and the Nightwise never even had a clue?
They can be a clueless lot, I said. Cops like easy, neat solutions. I didn't know what else to say. That seemed off to me, too.
So what's our play?
Vigil asked.
Everyone looked at me, and I really needed a drink. I hoped it didn't show. You and I have a date at the Iron Cauldron with Roland Blue tonight, I said to the knight.
It was pretty clear Glide and Blue don't get along, so I'm hoping I can use that to shake something loose.
Unless Glide was lying to you,
Anna said.
Roland Blue wants you dead, Latham.
Feeling's mutual, I said, but I have an unlimited checkbook on legs with uncanny fashion sense and serious ass-kicking skills going in there with me.
Vigil shook his head.
Don't remind me. I'll keep trying to pry loose whatever I can on Red Hat Productions and Glide,
Grinner said,
and I'll pack up to get the hell out of Dodge, too.
I have an idea,
Anna said, reaching for her leather coat.
Give me that piece of a prescription pad you found at Elektra's murder scene.
I handed her the torn slip of paper as she slid on her coat and slung her messenger bag.
I'll get back to you on this,
she said, examining the scrap.
You be care— I began. Anna silenced me with a finger over my lips.
Shh, she said.
She kissed me. Her kisses tasted like sunshine, flashing brilliant through cool rain. You were about to say something stupid.
19. Westmont was in a stranglehold between Englewood and Watts in south-central L.A. It was mostly Crips turf, which I never thought I'd be glad of, but MS-13 was nowhere to be seen around here, and that was good, because I can only deal with so many assholes at once. The Iron Cauldron was an institution of the life in the City of Angels. The Cauldron had been started as part of Roland Blue's fledgling empire built on Grotto. Roland pioneered Grotto, the fusion of the supernatural with the sex industry. If gonzo porn was the extreme and dangerous edge of mainstream smut, then Grotto was the life's version of gonzo turned up to 11. The Trevita purred like a big cat on the hunt as we glided up Van Ness Avenue. The radio was playing Bishop Briggs's River. I had less than 3 hours before I was supposed to be on a plane, or Gita was going to sick the most powerful, feared, and disciplined wizards in the world on my ass. I was driving, and Vigil was watching the street slip by us, hungry faces staring, washed in neon and ink.
It never really changes,
Vigil said. Just the names on the jerseys, I said, flicking away my third cigarette of the trip. You good? You and Dwayne coordinated? Vigil nodded.
Yeah. He's got us covered outside. Man's got his act together. Do I know him from somewhere? He famous or something?
He was huge in the MMA when he was younger. Was going to be a world champion. Then this city started talking to him, and he chucked it all to become a shaman. He's the best hand-to-hand man I've ever seen. We pulled up on the street before the slumbering shadow of the Cauldron. The reason the Nightwise had never been able to shut it down was that Roland's best friend and the Cauldron's original owner, Dirty Fifi, had worked a powerful magic over the old warehouse. Besides being all TARDIS-y, bigger on the inside than on the outside, it also just vanished and reappeared at random around the city, usually when the Nightwise were close to finding it again. The club sensed your intent, took your measure, kind of an anti-brilliant badge. A man like Vigil would never have found his way to the Iron Cauldron in a million years or been allowed inside alone. Welcome to my sewer. You are going to see some sick, next-level shit in here, I said, lighting another smoke. I'm not talking about a bunch of Silicon Valley execs puking their unresolved traumas out over a hot cup of ayahuasca. This can get bad and bad quick. It's the place the jaded and the bored and the truly disturbed go to be surprised. So I need you to be cool, okay? Vigil said nothing. You couldn't hear the music until you were up on the two fire doors around the back of the warehouse that acted as the Cauldron's main entrance. The doors were flanked by 7-foot-tall bouncers. The two giants had skin like dried and cracking gray plaster. Tiny, intricate Hebrew Kabbalic cipher symbols were painstakingly carved into their flesh in lines. They both wore do-rags that covered the prominent symbol on their foreheads, and they were dressed in dark Vivian Westwood tracksuits, the hoods up shrouding their faces. They didn't carry weapons. They had no need for them. Hey, Bartell, dear, I said as Vigil and I walked up on them. Good to see you guys found work after Sal passed, God rest his soul.
What do you want, Ballard?
Adir asked. His voice was strangely melodic and well-modulated, not harsh at all, almost beautiful.
Seems odd you'd be working for the guy that whacked your old boss, though, I said, Sal being your creator and all.
How about I rip your ugly head off your shoulders?
Bartell said,
shut that redneck mouth of yours once and for all.
Our deer raised his hand, placed it on his brother's chest.
Don't let him bait you, Bart,
our deer said.
What, Ballard?
Here to see the man, I said. No trouble, just conversation and spend a little money. Both Vigil and I allowed a deer to frisk us. We had no weapons on us.
You bring trouble with you,
our deer said.
But Mr. Blue said you might show up, though, and he told us to let you in. Don't give us a reason to break you and your friend, scumbag.
I smiled my best Sunday school teacher smile. You going to get the door for us? Bartell almost came at me, but our deer calmed him and opened the doors for us. Here's your tip, I said. Invest in spackle. You're looking a little crumbly. We walked in, and I didn't look back. The doors closed, and I could almost imagine Dwayne and Gretchen moving out of the darkness, closing on the two golems. I felt sorry for the stone man. The music was like hitting an invisible wall. The DJ was on a nest-like stage of sorts overlooking the main floor. I recognized him. He went by the handle DJ Tamur, and he was the reincarnation of a Polynesian sorcerer. I think I owed him money for some hash oil. He was playing a dance mix cover of Devo's Going Under. We descended the winding staircase to the main floor below, and Tamur waved when he saw me and then gestured with his fingers to the side of his head for me to call him. I heard the undercurrent of conversation all aimed at me and saw the looks, from excitement, like they had just seen an A-lister, to heads shaking and worried looks at me just being here. It's always good to have a diverse fan base.
Well, another subtle entrance,
Vigil said, taking a few steps ahead of me and opening a wedge for us through the crowd. Look, everyone in here is in the life, I said. Supernatural beings, magicians, entourages, tourists, or wannabes. I'm, you know, kind of famous with this demographic. What can I do?
Don't tempt me to answer that,
Vigil grumbled. I saw more familiar faces at a corner booth. I had been wanting to chat them up since Meat had mentioned they might have some information about Crystal. I diverted toward them. The weathermen were holding court, and it was, as always, a beautiful thing. Okay, a quick test. Name for me one TV weatherman that isn't a little odd. Every weatherman I've ever known has had some sort of quirk, some kink, some weird-ass hobby, and, oh, they all love the booze and the drugs, all of them. You party with a weatherman, you best be at fighting weight, or you'll find yourself in a hospital ER, an adrenaline needle in you, and having your stomach pumped. I guess if your life was all about standing in front of a green screen and pretending to be moving cold fronts around, you'd hit the sauce, and the party favors pretty regular, too. One night, at a very insane party, four L.A. weathermen discovered over a case of bourbon and a kilo of Peruvian flake that they had something in common besides a love of soothing baritone voices, a perverse sex act called a monkey face, and El Nino. They could do magic together. I'm talking real powerful high-order magic, and they could do this miracle as easily as cutting a ribbon at the opening of a new Dollar Tree. Thus, one of the life's oddest cabals was born. Oh, and don't mention Ron Burgundy around them. They are really sensitive about that shit. I hung at the fringes of the crowd surrounding the weatherman's table. They had groupies, and their parties were legendary, so they attracted lots of lampreys. Stan Sweetenberg, the oldest of the weathermen and the reigning U.S. quick-draw pistol champion, was telling a story about literally running into his idol, Johnny Carson, in the middle of an LSD-fueled daisy chain at a swingers party in Burbank circa 1979. Most of the kids in the crowd had no idea who the fuck Johnny Carson was, but Stan didn't let that get in the way of a good story.
So there I was, Stan said in his best broadcasting voice, with the king of late-night television's balls right in my sweet Mary. Latham Ballard, you old salty dog, get over here. Guys, it's Ballard.
I waved at Stan and his fellow weathermen and moved through the parting crowd to embrace the snow-white pompadour gunslinger. Still getting mileage out of Carson's junk, I see, Stan, I said as I hugged him. How you guys doing? This is Vigil Burris. Vigil nodded but kept scanning the crowd. Stan laid his palm out to give Vigil five, but the knight frowned and left the old man hanging. The 75-year-old reddened and refocused on me.
How long you in for this time? We're having a little camping trip set up for this weekend, and Clive found some primo mescaline. We're going to trip balls, open a gate to the Chinvat Bridge, and do a little limbo dancing. It will be cray-cray, man.
It's good blue cap, Ballard, The wooden ventriloquist dummy on the lap of a red-headed, bushy-mustached man said, "The dummy was dressed like and had the same hair and mustache as the redhead." The ventriloquist's name was Chet Webley, KTLA Action News Team Chief Meteorologist, who always did his broadcast with the help of his constant companion and wooden doppelganger, Clive Owen. Chet insisted that he had given Clive his name long before that Johnny-come-lately actor showed up and saw no reason to change it. "I wish I could, guys, but I'm on a clock," I said as I sat at their table. Vigil remained standing and kept scanning. "I wanted to ask you a question about one of your parties."
"Fire away, Latham,"
Red Blazer said. Red was big, balding, and black, the only one of the cabal that wasn't painfully white. Red, of course, was wearing his trademark fire engine red sports coat. He was a Gulf War vet, and his thing was Mongolian throat singing. "You had an industry girl at one of your dues a few years back," I said. "She goes by Crystal Myth. I'm looking for her. I'd owe you guys a solid if you could help me out."
"Oh, yeah,"
the final member of the cabal, Gustav Gus Gilwaski, said.
"I remember her. Sweet little PYT. She was Faye, one of Roland's party girls. Just breathtaking. You guys remember her. It was at Juan's Speculum and Fondue party."
The other three weathermen and Clive Owen all said, "Oh, yeah." Gus smiled and gave me a thumbs up. Gus was unhealthily skinny and had a thick mop of prematurely gray hair and equally thick, shaggy black eyebrows. Gus was the closest thing the cabal had to a leader. He was well known locally for his inexhaustible repertoire of card tricks and his devotion to animal rights causes. He was equally well known in the life for being the most powerful tyromancer on the planet.
"She was dating some porn producer, as I recall," Gus said. "Smarmy son of a bitch."
"Glad," I said. "Brett Glad." Gus and the others nodded.
"Yep, sounds right,"
Gus said.
"I remember them because of the big dust-up. It kind of dimmed the otherwise festive mood."
"What happened?" I asked.
"She came out of a room with a party guest," Stan said, picking up the story. "And she was crying. I saw her try to get to the head. But there was a line, and she got sick. Really badly. All over the carpet. I helped her outside," Red said. "She got sick again. She was really upset and scared. She said she thought she was pregnant again."
"Again?"
Vigil interjected. Red nodded.
"That's what she said. Then she got hysterical. I asked to use my phone, so I let her, and she apparently called a ride. She really didn't want company, especially after I told her shooting up with a bun in the oven was awful."
"Shooting up heroin?"
Vigil said. I gave him a dirty look. He gave me one back.
"She said it didn't matter," Red said. "Then she told me to fuck off, and I did."
"Anybody see who picked her up?" I asked. Gus drained his absinthe before he replied.
"For like 2 seconds," he said. "There was drama out on the porch. Her boyfriend, Glide, was grabbing at her, and he seemed pissed, but still really chill. It was weird. This kid pulled up in his car and tried to get her away from the boyfriend. He ended up pushing Glide back and pointing a gun at him. Krista looked like she was nodding pretty hard by this point. She went with the kid, and they peeled out. End of amusing anecdote."
"Gus, you remember what the kid looked like? His car? A tag?" The weathermen laughed as a collective.
"Ballard, this was just before our GHB period,"
Clive Owen said, speaking for Chet.
"You're lucky they made enough of an impression to still be clinging in our cerebral cortexes."
The waitress brought another round. Stan had ordered me his favorite, a dark and stormy, and I wanted it so fucking bad. I held the cold glass, licked my dry lips, and set it down. I wanted to scream and punch a fucking wall. "Thanks, guys, but I'm working. Like I said, TikTok. Anything you can give me would be a huge help."
"I could do some divination," Gus said. "See what I can pull up. I got some fresh Gouda bubbling in a cooler in my basement. I'll need time, some dark, and quiet."
I gave Gus my number. I also asked Red if he'd mind if Grinner tried to track that number Crystal had called from his phone records.
"Sure,"
Red said, scribbling down his old cell number on a napkin.
"But that was like 3 phones and 2 phone companies ago. But go for it, man."
"Incoming,"
Vigil said. I glanced over my shoulder. 2 of Blue's pit bosses and 4 of his muscle, all dressed fashionably in Vigil's hand-me-downs, were moving through the ring of weatherman groupies.
"Thanks, guys, I owe you," I said and stood.
"Fight the power, Ballard," Stan said.
Chet raised Clive Owen's tiny fist in solidarity. Red tipped his scotch in salute, and Gus gave me his trademark thumbs up, Vigil and I turned to face our welcome wagon.
Mr. Blue's been expecting you, Ballard, said one of Blue's old crew chiefs, a greasy guy with bad skin who I vaguely recalled was a were-rat named Joyce. This way.
20. The music in the club was In This Moment's Blood as we made our way toward an old cage-style elevator hidden in the smoke and shadow at the edge of the main floor. Vigil and I were surrounded by our escorts in the cage. The elevator jerked and rose as we headed past the antique tin ceiling tiles of the main floor. Where we were headed was by invitation only. I gave Vigil a quick look, trying to convey, be cool. As usual, he was sphinx-like. The second floor was less elegant, more functional. There were rising bleachers upholstered in leather, ringing a round stage encircled by an ornate wrought iron cage. Directly at eye level for the stage were large, gothic, baroque high-back chairs for the clients who didn't want to miss a single nuance of the performance and could pay for that. The bleachers held about 100 people and were pretty full. The chairs in the front were sold out. The crowd looked rich and bored. That's why they came to Rollin' Blue, for the things money couldn't buy. There was no music up here. The stage was mic'd, so every sound, every utterance was audible to the crowd. Staircases led to the rafters where our guides were taking us, and I counted at least 4 men on the catwalk above us with AK-47s slung. I was pretty sure there were more, and I knew Vigil had scoped out every single one.
Come on,
Joyce muttered as he led us to the stairs. The lights dimmed and the crowd grew still.
The 12:15 show is starting. Keep quiet.
There was a creaking of the stage floor as a man in a leather-zippered gimp mask led an animal onto the stage. At first I thought it was a horse, then I heard the gasp slip from Vigil's pursed lips, and I knew, and even my stomach turned a little. The unicorn's hide was dingy. Once per lesson, it was now mottled with gray patches, scratches, stripes from whips, brand marks, and dirt. The iron collar covered with runes of binding and negation had rubbed a raw spot on its neck. The creature's alicorn was almost 3 feet long and still shimmered like it wasn't entirely real, not trapped in this world like its owner. The unicorn looked over to the stairway and seemed to look straight at me. They could sense power. And besides it, I was the most powerful thing in the room. The eyes weren't pleading, weren't beaten, just full of pain and a deep sadness like it was very disappointed. The unicorn's gaze was an indictment of the human race. I wanted to look away, but I didn't. It didn't send a telepathic message to me asking for help. I wondered if it couldn't because of the collar, its sickly condition, or if it just knew it would fall on deaf ears. I kept walking up the stairs. Vigil remained, looking down into the light, matching the unicorn's stare.
What is wrong with these people?
He asked, his hands clutching the stairs rail. The knight looked to me, almost pleading. I shouldn't have brought him here. This was sick shit, and he was a good man. He had no business being this deep in hell. A second gate opened on the side of the stage, and a being entered that looked like a young woman with teal skin and long, tangled hair the color of dark seaweed. She wore a leather corset and fishnets with garters. It was a sea nymph, and she was collared as well. Her shoulders slumped, and she shuffled instead of walking. She didn't look up, and she almost cried when she looked at the unicorn and moved toward it, but I was pretty sure the sea maiden had no tears left in her. I glanced over to Joyce, his face bland contempt. The fucking Tijuana donkey show? Really? Class.
Watch your fucking mouth, has been.
Blue's right-hand man said, pointing up the stairs.
You and your boyfriend can have a good cry after you see Mr. Blue. Move it.
I looked back to Vigil as the crowd began to whoop and whistle. I had shaken hands with what I saw in his eyes many, many times in my life. He was close to a dangerous edge.
Vigil, I said as calmly as I could. Come on, ma'am. We got an appointment.
Burris began to climb the steps, his jaw tight, his muscles coiled. We were ushered into Roland Blue's office suite.
The window behind his desk looked down into the arena where the nymph and the unicorn were beginning their performance. Blue stood as we entered with his men. The office was decorated in early contemporary street thug makes good. Too much gilt, too much flash. The kind of tacky, expensive shit that someone who grew up on the street and got paid would pick out. Someone so scary that no one would tell them their taste sucked. In keeping with his name and his trademark attire, most of the room was done in shades of blue with gold, too, just to remind you he had it. Roland himself hadn't changed much since we'd last tussled. A few more lines around his eyes, which were always the color of whomever he was talking to, or an unnerving polychromatic if he was addressing more than one person. His hair was long and dirty blonde, but the gray was catching up fast. He was dressed in a cobalt chiton suit with a black dress shirt. The shirt had wingtip collar blades. He wore a cerulean tie. Roland's patron, a long-forgotten Persian demon, existed anywhere that the color cerulean was present. It was the reason for his street name, the only name he had left since he had undertaken a ritual to blot out his true name with innocent blood. "Latham Ballard," Blue said, that too-wide, too-toothy grin spreading across his face. "He said my name is Ballard," his voice pure Boston. "You got a lot of fucking balls to come begging at my door. I could tell my boys to kill you right now." "You'd lose a lot of men, asshole," I said, taking a chair in front of his Florence Knoll table desk topped with gold-veined black marble, "and you'd fucking die, too." Blue's men chuckled a little, nervously.
"You want we should take this bum outside and teach him some manners, Mr. Blue?" Joyce asked, his eyes red pinpricks of light. Blue waved him off.
"Ollie, get the fuck out of here. I got old business with this skid, private business. Screw."
Vigil, standing by my side, looked to me. "It's cool," I said. "They give you any shit, you do what you gotta do."
"Gladly," Vigil said, looking at Blue.
Vigil, Joyce, and the rest of Blue's soldiers took it outside and closed the door. Blue walked over to his bar, dropped globes of ice from a bucket into a pair of short glasses, and poured us each a finger of Jameson Rarest.
"Nice, huh? I clashed the joint up after I gave old Fifi the heave-haw."
"Fifi was your best friend," I said. "The way I hear it, you punched his ticket without so much as a sit-down."
"Yeah," Blue said. "Fucking A, and look who gets a sit-down. Life's a mystery, eh, Latham? What the fuck you doing here? You out of your fucking skull coming back to L.A.?"
"I came for a missing person's job, Raleigh," I said, taking the offered drink. I sat it down on the edge of the desk. It seemed a million light years away from my mouth. I could smell the whiskey, and I licked my dry lips. It ended up complicated.
"Yeah, no shit, I got ears," Blue said, returning to his seat and sipping his drink. "You pissed on the Maras, the fucking Cambodian, even your own crew, the Owls. They're all gunning for you, and I sure as hell ain't gonna give you sanctuary. This ain't no fucking church, and I ain't no fucking priest."
"Not looking, not asking," I said.
"Good," Blue said. "You still hate me, I can see it. You should. I know I still hate your cracker ass."
"I think you had Nico killed," I said, "cut in half with a fucking 12-gauge in front of his wife and kids. I came for you the night he died. You ever hear that? You can thank the Maven and Dragon for saving your life, Raleigh."
"The Maven," Blue laughed. "Well, ain't that a pisser? Let me enlighten you about that, Ballard. First off the jump, don't think you're still fucking Gandalf. Your ass is old and used up. Most of what made you so fucking powerful, such a big fucking shot, you flushed it away. I could take you then, and I sure as hell could take you now. If old Gaetus saved anyone's life that night, it was yours, and that was because you were fucking her. And two, I liked Nico. There was no bullshitting in him. He was a good cop. He knew when to take and when to look the other way. He had a line, you fucked with him and he'd fuck you back hard. His dying was bad for everyone's business, especially mine. Why kill cops when you can rent 'em? Nico was all right, but you, Ballard, you I hated the first time I laid eyes on your shit-kicking smart ass. You want to know who got Nico killed? You look in the fucking mirror if you haven't already hocked your reflection.
I want to know about Brett Glide and about Crystal Myth. Blue laughed and then drained his drink. I saw the ice shift in my full glass. It was goddamned obscene to let smooth as silk whiskey just sit there and get watered down. Sacrilege. I flicked my eyes back to Blue's. They were my eyes.
The light fucking dawns, he saluted me with his empty glass. How many years you been sniffing around that shit and you finally got a fucking clue? Good for you.
I don't take you for a dug for Raleigh, I said, so I'll figure you for being their pimp. How's it work exactly? Glad aims women that have potential as sacrifices toward you and then you tag team them to drag them down into the sewer, something like that?
Close enough, Blue said, rising and refilling his drink. You need anything, Ballard, while I'm up?
I shook my head curtly, tried not to look at the drink on the desk.
You know, you're looking in the fucking bag awful rough, awful old. You need to do better by you. Life's too fucking short.
Your concern is touching, Raleigh, really. All I'm looking for is the girl, Crystal. My client can make it worth your while. I'm going to shut the dope down, but you don't have to be part of that if you help me.
Blue returned back to his desk with a fresh drink. Mine was sitting there sweating and getting nastier by the second. It was bad manners. I was being a bad guest. Your client, Blue said. You mean Theo Ankou, her pops, right?
I kept my gaze even, trying to not give him anything. Blue nodded.
Yeah, her old man, the Ankous, they got some juice, but I hope you're not planning on getting paid, Ballard. I already barked up that tree.
What the hell are you talking about? I asked.
That fucking piece of shit Glide, Blue said. He discovered her, Crystal, whatever her fucking name was, and eventually he aimed her at me. We both knew she wasn't human, that she was fey. I know, man, let me tell you what a sweet piece of ass she was, too. You ever bite into a ripe piece of fruit and have it dribble down your chin? Fucking sick, man. So the way this little bitch talks and acts, all lace curtain, I figured her for slumming, and I figured that Mumsy and Dadsy will pay big not to see their little princess taking a pipe on YouTube. So I start digging and I find out she's the fucking thin white duke, Theodore Ankou's fucking daughter. Holy shit, right? Like hitting the fucking Powerball, you'd think.
You telling me you reached out to Ankou about his daughter? I leaned forward. My nerves were screaming. I couldn't tell if it was what Blue was saying or my aching thirst for that drink, but I felt jumpy as hell.
Nah, I never got the chance, he said. Crystal took off on me, on Glide, on everybody. I was going to rescue her from Glide and the Dugpa and get her old man to give me a nice retirement reward so I could head for warmer, safer climes.
Rescue, I said. Blue shrugged and sipped his whiskey. Behind and below him, the crowd howled as the performance on the stage reached some new hallmark of depravity.
You seriously going to give up L.A., Raleigh? All that power you've been scraping for your whole miserable life, that doesn't sound like you.
I crossed the Dugpa over the girl. I can't stay here, he said.
They had already given Crystal the sacrificial mark. You know about that, right?
Yeah, I figured you're a fucking professor, Ballard. I fucked them over for Ankou. I'd end up as one of their sick fucking psychological experiments, end up offing myself or something, or they'd send old Crash Card out for me. No thanks.
You saying you couldn't handle the heat from a bunch of pervy Buddhists, Raleigh? My nerves felt like they were being plucked by talons of ice. I was breathing heavier, sweating a little. I wasn't sure why. Maybe it was fighting off the urge to drink.
How the mighty have fallen.
You joke all you want, Latham, Blue said. Those fuckers been creeping around this city a long time before you and me were swimming on our pop's balls. As far back as there have been people coming here with dreams. That's power, baby. Hardcore, hardwired power. They own L.A. Shit, they own me and a lot more than me. They used to own you, too, and you were too fucking stupid to know it. Why you think I'm being so goddamned accommodating till you're telling you all this shit? They told me you were coming, told me to expect you, told me that you'd spoken with that psycho Manson. They told me you weren't to be harmed unless you got unreasonable. They got plans for you, Ballard.
Who runs the cult, Raleigh? I asked. Who's in charge? Is it Glide?
Blue snorted. Brett Glide, shit, little pissant. He don't wipe his ass without clearing it with...
He shut up. He was scared of them, really scared of them, and that scared me.
Something was trying to get my attention. Something was wrong on a basic subatomic level. Some metaphysical fire alarm was screaming. I was close to what I needed. I focused on Blue.
Look, I don't know no name except Glides, period, end of fucking sentence.
Right, I said. Well, here's another name you might be familiar with. I said the name. That was a common, northern, blue-collar American name, nothing special, except to the person who